Our speaker, Richard. I'll leave the rest to you, okay? And I think I've done enough speaking.
I suppose this is what happens when you've had a couple of Stellas before you start lecturing. Thank you for having me. It was really a great pleasure to be invited to speak. And as you'll find out, and those who know me will know half of the story, if not all of the story already. Those who don't, you'll see from the title that life progressed but differently, infers that something quite dramatic changed. But it was, yeah, whatever works best for you, to be honest. What's truly amazing was when I had my accident, which is coming up to 13 years ago, was how well supported I was and my family were too. And so being asked to do this in a small way is a really wonderful opportunity for me to give back to a community who showed so much love and support to me and my family throughout. What follows is a health warning, though, because I'm going to talk about my own experience. And I'm acutely aware that there will be people in the audience who will have had their own journey, potentially with disability or with family members with disability or whatever else might have happened too. And mine is broadly a good news story. It's had its challenges. It's not all been milk and honey. But of course, that's not the same scenarios that everyone faces. So this is just a reminder that this is a description of what has happened to me and how I have spent the last 12 years, 13 years coming to terms with my disability. And it's not to say that it's the path that will be available to everyone or that everyone might have. I guess the first thing to say is that life actually progressed quite normally for about 21 years, and trying to work out how many days, 1 month and a few days. I'm a product of a loving family. Father was in the military, I suppose, but I can't hold it against him too much. You know, loving childhood, brought up in Loxheath, born in Portsmouth. Proud Portsmouth boy, but living halfway between Southampton and Portsmouth. And actually, for my early years, and through my adolescence and all the rest of it, I had a very normal upbringing. If I track through my life, you know, I went to St. John's and Parkgate and Brookfield, and then on to Itching College. And then, you know, I suppose a relatively large decision was had in which university that I might go to. It was narrowed down quite easily by a couple of universities rejecting me. So that's fine. And that I spent 3 wonderful years at the University of Birmingham, meeting, you know, friends who you know, I spend my time with to date, and I've really enjoyed. I obviously enjoyed the sort of 3 hedonistic years of fantastic social life and all the rest of it. But I've also enjoyed them growing up, I suppose. It seems a bit weird to say that, but them buying houses, having careers, having kids and things like that. Graduated, probably one of my proudest days, I guess, in July 2006. And after a summer of travelling and seeing the world and all the rest of it, joining KPMG on their graduate training programme, which is kind of like, I know, loving parents, supportive parents, not helicopter parents telling me that I should do this or should do that, but kind of the story that most people might want for their kids. And then I did something really stupid. I went up to a freshers' week that I was overqualified for because I graduated, and I probably was there to impress young female new students and to see my friends and have a good time. all of which would, sounds like a good idea, apart from I had an exam on the Monday following that weekend. But I didn't really make it to that exam. And for those who don't know, I had a bit too much to drink, probably a little bit more than a bit too much to drink, at the Students' Union. I spent the entire evening convincing my friends that it would be an excellent idea to jump into the university fountain, which had water in it for one of the few days a year. It had been an open day just before that. And jumping into the fountain probably would have been a bit stupid, but would have been okay, apart from I'd had a bit too much to drink. And although I had the foresense to take my university hoodie off, to take my wallet and phone out of my pocket so they wouldn't get wet, as I walked towards it, I put my hands over my head and I did a racing dive. It's dangerous. Don't do it. 100% of the people that I've known to dive into the fountain, which is admittedly just one, have come off a cropper. And the weird thing is, although I was inebriated, I actually remember pretty much everything that happened. I remember walking towards the fountain. I remember diving into it. And I remember waking up face down in the fountain, having hit my head or acknowledging that something had happened, going, okay, know where I am, know why I'm in here, I need to get out. And I remember trying to stand up, and I couldn't. And I opened my eyes, not something I normally do in water, and I could see the turquoise bottom of the fountain, and I could see my arms floating in front of me, and I thought, well, okay, at this point, I need to push my way out. And something about the neurology of the level of spinal injury that I'd had meant that my arms were effectively floating fairly limply in front of me. And then I thought, well, I need to breathe at least. So I need to roll over. And I tried to move my arms. And I could see that my arms were moving a little bit, but I was obviously not rolling over in the way that you normally would. And at this point, I thought, oh, shit. And I had no idea how many seconds this had been. It was not a long period of time because, for all intents and purposes, for all of the people that were there at the time, I was pulled out of the fountain very quickly by a security guard. And I was, out the fountain on my back, laid on my back, and I remember the security guard sort of saying, we're going to put you in recovery position. Can you move your legs? And I sort of said, no. I said, don't joke about that. I said, I'm not. Please call an ambulance. And they said, don't worry, one is on its way. And I guess to some extent, this is where, my, although cataclysmically bad luck, my luck started. I had an accident in a really public place. And the ambulance station was 400 meters away from the Students' Union. Not a deliberate design, I don't think, but something that was there. And so I was admitted into A&E, and on the way, the sort of diagnoses were going through my mind, and it did strike me that it was probably the last thing I ever thought I would think that day would be, oh my goodness, I'm paralysed. And within half an hour, I had asked whether or not I'd walk again, and looking at the spinal or the x-ray that came out, and this isn't the x-ray that came out, that was the x-ray after I'd been straightened up after my operation. But we could see the bones sticking into what was a black cavity, which is your spinal cord, and the consultant, quite frankly, just said, looking at this, I don't think you'll ever walk again. Not that I believed him at that time, because you don't, especially when you're 21. Arrogant and all the rest of it. At that point, I mean, throughout this time, lots of people had been asking whether or not I would like to contact anyone. I was surrounded by my friends at the time, who had, by the way, spent their entire evening trying to convince me not to jump into the fountain. But obviously, you can't stop someone doing something that they really want to do. And at this point, when I'd seen the x-ray, I'd been told the diagnosis, I said yes. But unfortunately, as my parents know, They were on a cruise celebrating their 25th wedding anniversary. So I didn't pick a great time either. So I called my sister, and she was absolutely fantastic. She raced over from Leicester to look after me and fight my corner effectively, because I have huge respect for the NHS, and I think they're a wonderful institution, but A&E has lots of pressures, especially on a Saturday night. And it was amazing to have her by my side to get a consultant out of bed when she had told the registrar that he was doing the wrong thing by not doing a full CT scan and all the rest of it, and suggesting that that he called the consultant, and then he did call the consultant. Consultant A asked why he was being woken up, and B then reminded him that he should be doing that. And so to have that support was absolutely incredible. And parents and friends and other family members soon joined after. And that started a really lengthy period in hospital, 9 months, a week and a day. For someone who previously thought 4 hours in A&E was a long time. And I was admitted initially to A&E and then to the Selly Oak Hospital, but soon, again, luckily for me, I was transferred to Oswestry, where I had my spinal C-spine fixing between C4 and C6, which is a pretty high-level spinal injury. After that, after 6 weeks there or 5 weeks there, I was lucky enough to be brought down to Oswestry. Salisbury District Hospital, and have my rehabilitation there. And this is really where, you know, the journey for me probably changed in comparison to an awful lot of people. I effectively had worked and had support for the first 21 years of my life to get into a really, really good position, and a position which I thought I'd completely thrown away. And I was really lucky again when I called in sick, which is a bit weird to call in sick when this has just happened to you in person, but to call in sick to your employer and basically tell them that I've been to the induction, and I was aware that I had to call in sick, and that I should contact the college too, because I was training, but I didn't have their number. And finally, getting round to the point where they asked me, "So it sounds quite serious. You're in hospital. Do you mind if I ask what happened?" I said, "Don't worry. Everything will be okay. I've broken my neck. I'm paralysed from the shoulders down." At which point, the poor person who was on the end of the phone line diligently finished the rest of the call and then put the phone down and promptly burst into tears. And what was extraordinary was the next phone call wasn't to me, but it was my parents. It was a senior partner, the guy who had interviewed me and onboarded me at the firm. And to paraphrase the conversation, it went something along the lines of, you know, clearly we're deeply, you know, traumatized about what's happened, you know. But as and when Richard is ready or wants to get back to work, we've had a wheelchair user in the office before. And if he wants to, his job is there waiting for him. And the difference that made at that early position, my time in hospital, where I couldn't even fathom getting back to work, really, what that would mean, or the hoops or the hurdles I'd have to go through, did mean that I had an objective and a target. And it seems really weird that your target is to go back to work as being an accountant, as your motivating factor in life. But it was utterly transformative. And if I reflect on it and I think about the difference between my peers who were in the spinal unit and myself at that time, people who had families were dealing with kids and the change in circumstances, income, all the rest of it. Not something that I had to particularly deal with. Others were electricians, plumbers, whatever it might be, who knew that their method of making a living was not going to be the same going forward. And so that objective and that target was incredibly important for me. And when I reflect later on, and I talk about later on in the talk, gives me a real sense of purpose about the importance of work, the importance of not necessarily work in a normal context, but the importance of contribution to disabled people, but the people in general. The idea that you can do something for society is really, really important in socializing you, in helping you deal with your own issues. Hospital was also not all bad. The photo is quite small, but that is I don't know if it was my leaving do or someone else's leaving do, but there was a lot of fun had in hospital, and it's slightly strange. I don't keep in touch with lots of people that I was with in hospital, but there's a real sense of camaraderie. You're up against something pretty rubbish, and you're all in the same process. So you celebrate those milestones of getting out of bed, of beating a pressure sore, if that was holding you back, of someone getting discharged, or someone, I don't know, being able to walk again, which does happen occasionally with spinal injury. And so, I mean, I think it's a lot plainer now, but there was a lot of booze had, and a lot of parties had, and a lot of potentially quite inappropriate behaviour that went on. So that was great. As a rehabilitation, well, it's not a normal form of rehab, I know. If you're in rehab for other reasons, then you probably want to stay off the sauce. But it was a really good experience, and again, something that I'm hugely appreciative of. And again, as I've sort of travelled after my accident, I've found that there's, we're truly lucky. I know we give the NHS a hard time, or if we don't, the media give the NHS an extraordinary hard time. And there are issues and there are problems, but we are extraordinarily lucky to have that institution there. And there's also the unforgettable help of so many throughout. Fundraisers here, people who hosted concerts, people who did sponsored runs, people who raised money by walking the test way. One of my best friends' dad, who got his incredibly hairy back waxed. I mean, it was. There are lesser forms of torture, because that guy was like, he had a carpet on his back. But also voluntary organisations too. Wheelchair rugby clubs that would come into the spinal unit, who would sort of teach you how to play sport. All of those things really changed, like genuinely changed the outlook, the opportunities that I had. And they've informed, you know, my contribution back to help run clubs and societies afterwards, because I've benefited from the generosity of others. And so I feel it's the least I can do now after, you know, I've dealt with the majority of the outcomes of my accident, that I can give some time and expertise back to help run things. Getting back to work was the target. And it might seem slightly odd, as I said, to want to get back to work, and for that to be such an ambition. But it really was, because work was normality. It was what I was planning to do. And then it's strange how some things happen, but literally 365 days after my accident, I went back to work. 1 year after my accident, I went back to work. I was doing exactly the same job. Curiously, I was sat at exactly the same desk. But as I said to my colleagues, I just had a very different chair. And it was a struggle, and rehabilitation was a struggle at hospital too, because when you're lying in bed, you're struggling to come, you're trying to get to terms with things in your head, but you don't really know where your low is until you get out of bed, and especially when you're quadriplegic or tetraplegic, as I am, and I have very little dexterity in my hands and fingers, and I have very little power in my upper body. You realize how extraordinarily weak you are. Now, I remember starting work for those 2 weeks and being quite tired after my first day. But I soon acclimatized to it. After a year and after the rehabilitation and after being confined to a wheelchair, I did 3 hours on my first day. And to be honest, I don't really do a lot other than sit upright and look at through a bit of paperwork. And I remember coming home, holding onto the kitchen table, shaking through fatigue. And that development, or trying to go from there through to what was 3 hours a day for 2 days a week, then 4 hours a day, 3 days a week, and then building it up slowly to full time, was something that my head wanted to do instantaneously, but something that my body rebelled against. And it took a long time to build up that stamina. But the office were incredibly supportive. They got me back to work, and I spent a year working part-time, and then 2 years after my accident, I started on my graduate training contract again, started taking my chartered accountancy exams. Learning how to write again was interesting, having to use splints. Learning how to type, I used to be able to touch type before my accident, and now having to use a stylus or some splints was pretty tough. But the organisation were incredibly supportive. I had one bout of, one time where again my head was racing ahead, wanting to compete with all my peers, and it was starting to leave my body behind. I was looking at my peers, and if you know anything about chartered accountancy or audit, you'll know that people work pretty long hours, and I was trying to replicate the same. And I started to fall to pieces. I really struggled. I went into my appraisal meeting expecting to get a glowing review because I felt rubbish, because I was really tired, and getting knocked back and being told that actually my work wasn't quite up to scratch, and feeling really miserable afterwards. And the company addressed, and I raised the problem of my, the difficulties I was having with work, and the company addressed that, and they adjusted the clients that I worked with and the deadlines that I was up against. But again, my 20-something year old, I'm just going to say male, but I think just 20-something year old young person brain was now saying, I've got all these handouts, I'm now not competing with my peers truly and fairly. So the company were doing everything they were legally, morally, and could possibly be expected to do. And I was still a little dissatisfied. And this is where I think I was really lucky again. I had a fantastic appraising partner who just said to me quite frankly, I don't think audit's going to be for you. It's a little nerve-wracking when your boss says that. You're only 22 years old, 23 years old, and you've just put a deposit down on a house. But he was right. And what he wanted me to do was go forward and to try teaching at KPMG and try teaching in their internal training program. And that was a bit of a revelation. But I threw myself into work in other ways too. There's a student chartered accountants, or there's a Southern Chartered Accountants Student Society, not the coolest sounding student society ever, but they hosted events, and one of the first events that I attended was upstairs in a bar. And so I felt a little dejected, but I'm quite pleased that I didn't become the big angry disabled person, because occasionally you have to do that, but there are times to do it and there's times not to. And I was really pleased that I just volunteered to join the committee instead, to be an ever-present reminder that events needed to be accessible and to host some events that I thought would be good. And that was really useful because it got me onto volunteering for all sorts of things. I set a world record for the world's, one of these corporate world records that's never been done before. So it's not a real world record, it's just something no one's ever done before. The world's largest multiple location synchronized mass taekwondo display. So I got my old garbs on from taekwondo from before my accident, and we had a really good time. And I volunteered for other things, and that, you know, gave me opportunities to go up to Chartered Accountants Hall and speak to the great and the good. I also had to learn how to have a lot of fun again. I'm lucky that someone described me as someone who had happiness hardwired in. Not strictly true. I had my ups and downs, and especially I find whenever something doesn't, when I find I have a setback, I struggle to deal with it. But it took me a long time to figure out, well, your parents probably disagree with saying it, it would take me a long time to figure out how to have fun again. But it took me a while to figure out how to have fun, especially since I have permanent live-in care. And so, although it's a real privilege to have that, it can kind of get in the way a little bit of having someone shadowing you all the time. So working out when to use my mates and when not to use my mates to help me with a little bit of personal care, just so we're kept keeping within the group. Knowing what your limits are, knowing what's accessible and not accessible and all the rest of it. But I have had a really, really, truly fantastic group of friends, people that I went to university with, that I did sport with, people that I lived with at university, and the people that I trained with at work too. And I suppose the next big leap for me was trying to find my true vocation. I thought when I was 21 and I joined KPMG that I would be, you know, partner, and this was it, the big corporate life, it's what I wanted. I was 21, I mean, that's what a lot of my students want now. They are Goldman Sachs, JP Morgan, Big Four, big corporates and all the rest of it, and it's what they aspire to. And that's great. But I increasingly found that although the company had looked after me incredibly well, audit wasn't going to be it for me. I'm not actually that good of an accountant. It's a bit worrying given I never teach it. Those 6 months, and the appraising partner who prompted me to go and try teaching internally at KPMG really changed my life, because I was sat down in front of a classroom similar to this, slightly less respectful classroom, but and I thought, crikey, you know what, I can do this. I can do this as well as an able-bodied person, potentially even better. I mean, weirdly, there's something about my neurology that means that I can't actually go red in the face. It's impossible. I only breathe diaphragmatically, so it's really hard for me to get that sort of tightness of voice that you get when you're a little bit nervous. And it's something really reassuring about being sat down, because your knees aren't jangling and your feet aren't fidgeting, or at least my feet aren't fidgeting. And I thought, crikey, actually, I'm almost built for this now. But I really enjoyed it too. And the thing that I enjoyed the most is that, and I don't know if there are any teachers in the room, but it's that sense of growth that you give to people. It's learning. It's a virtuous industry to be, or a virtuous thing to do, even if you are teaching people how to do double entry bookkeeping and, you know, financial analysis and audit and stuff like that. And I spent 6 months doing it, and I thought, crikey, how do I do this full time? I was due to go back into working an audit busy season, and again, another stroke of luck. I could have stayed within KPMG, but they were only offering a 1 year fixed term contract for this type of work, and it would have required moving out of my new house in Totten and moving to Watford, which, you know, Watford's okay, but it's a lot more expensive than Totten and not particularly much nicer. And this is where I was really lucky. Again, a position at Solent University, at Southampton Solent University, as it was there, came up. And the words came to me quite easily for the application. I put my CV in. I didn't think anything of it. I was only 26. And this was for a senior lecturing position. And I was slightly flabbergasted to get a call for the interview, having had no real teaching experience, just a small bit in the house. And I went to the interview, and it went perfectly well. But I was quite surprised again that I wasn't expecting a callback, because I'd met the other candidates, and there's someone who had 30 years teaching experience. And I just thought, you know what, this is it's unlikely to happen, something I want to do, but unlikely to happen. And I got a call, and they wanted me to sign up. And then I had this really, really difficult decision to make, leaving an organisation who had been so good to me, had taken me from a hospital bed, helped rehabilitate me into the workplace, put me through my professional qualification, bent over backwards to try and facilitate my needs, and finally given me this great insight into teaching and something that I wanted, you know, and given me an opportunity to learn something about myself, about something I wanted to do. And so I had this pros and cons checklist of things that I, yeses and no's, pluses and minuses. And depending on what I thought, and then, you know, I'd add an extra point in, and I couldn't get anywhere near, or I couldn't get away from a 50-50 decision. And the thing that swung it for me was that if I stayed within the company, I would probably have to leave the area. And if I was leaving the area, I may be loyal to the company, but I'd probably lose contact with all of those people who had been so supportive for me. And so that's what made my decision to leave. My decision to leave was, ironically, to stay close to the people who've been so good to me. And it has panned out really well. I spent 2.5 years at Solent University. I did some interesting things whilst I was there. And more recently, I have moved up to, actually more recently, 4 and a bit years ago, moved up to the University of Southampton to teach there. And I love it. And part of the reason why I love it is because academia gives me the opportunity to give back. It allows me, or it gives me the time to join clubs, societies, to support others, to help students on their way. So, one of those things, and one of those, when I joined Solent University, one of the things that I was not keen to do at the outset, but one of the things that ended up happening and taking over my life for about two years, was a Paralympic Legacy project. When I joined Solent University, if you know anything about the institution, it's a sports-orientated, sports, fashion, media-orientated university. It was a Paralympic year. I somehow had managed to get 12 tickets to the London 2012 Games, boxing heavyweight final, 100 metres final, tennis finals, diving finals. For some reason, I was incredibly lucky. And lots of people, once I joined university, were just asking, well, if you played a sport, what would it be? And I said, it would be wheelchair rugby, something that used to be called murder ball. And every one of them that asked me would say, oh, you should speak to Dr. Stuart Bruce Lowe. Okay, noted. Next conversation, what would your sport be? Wheelchair rugby. You should go and speak to Dr. Stuart Bruce Lowe. And on and on and on. So I finally figured out it's probably a good idea I find out who this guy is. And he was a professor at the university who happened to be the GB sports, the GB wheelchair rugby sports scientist in the lead up to the games, in the lead up to the Paralympic Games. And it also happened that a guy called Aaron Phipps was, you know, the UK's, I'm going to say best, most able, and he would say best. Knowing the guy, I describe him as the Fonz of the club. He has that swagger amongst him. But he lived in Totten, literally 500 metres from my house. But there was no club in Southampton. And part of the reason why I hadn't had much of a sporting life, I tried wheelchair tennis, but I wasn't quite able enough to do it. I did general gym work and I swam, but, you know, didn't have any sort of edge of competitiveness about it. I couldn't do wheelchair rugby because the closest teams were North London or Cardiff, which if you're in Southampton and working full time and they train during the week, isn't going to happen. And so I thought, crikey, London 2012, Paralympic legacy, sports scientist at Solent University, Aaron Phipps living just down the road, finding out that there were some taster sessions taking place in the New Forest anyway, I thought, I have to get involved. I wouldn't forgive myself if this opportunity for something to blossom just died away. And so I put my hand up, helped organise the taster sessions, and with a couple of people, one of whom lives locally, and the other one who sadly passed away a few years ago, set up this club, and we brought it under the university's banner, because you might think after London 2012 there would be a Paralympic legacy fund. No. In fact, the funding, and it's not necessarily the organisations, the funding stopped literally the month after London 2012. So this legacy was purely voluntary. And if I give you some indications about how much it costs to set up a team to play wheelchair rugby, and if you're playing rugby, you need 15 jerseys, and you need 15 pairs of boots, presumably some shorts, and you need a field and a ball, and you're done. To play wheelchair rugby, you all need chairs, and you need court time. And each of these chairs costs £3,000 to £5,000. And court time costs £45 an hour. And so we approached the national governing body. They said, we could lend you 3 chairs, and we don't have any money. And then they took 2 of those chairs away after the first week. And so I was thinking, right, what's the out here? And again, I'm lucky and very fortunate that Solent University believed in the project, and they still do. And they invested £50,000, and they trusted £50,000 to a member of staff who had only been there for 4 months to set up a wheelchair rugby club. They provided free hall time to help keep the club going. And I'd like to say it's been an extraordinary success on the field. It's not. It's been quite mixed. But the club's still going. I chaired it for the first 3 years whilst I was working at Solent University. But it was extraordinary. An opportunity, a sort of a selfish reason to get into a sport. I want to play the sport, so I'll volunteer to help run it. But I've met extraordinary people along the way. I mean, Pete Hull is one. An MBE, triple gold winning Paralympic swimmer, who I just thought was Pete. In fact, I went to an event And I sort of said, Pete, who's this triple gold winning Paralympic swimmer? And he was like, Rich, it's me. He's like, I did wonder how you got that MBE, but... But I met some extraordinary people, people who volunteered to help run the club and still run it now. And that gave me crazy, silly opportunities by, like, running while running, wheeling with the Commonwealth baton, being featured on, you know, South Today, going up to the ICAW to receive a prize for charitable work. And it's been hugely fulfilling because however much I might think, oh, you know what, I actually quite like a lion on a Saturday. When I get into my chair and have a smash around, I always come out feeling considerably calmer and better than I did when I went in. I like travel and adventure too. I did have a first relaxing holiday. I went to Brussels. It's a bit of a weird location to go for a holiday, but I thought, they speak English, and they don't mind speaking English, unlike France, where they deeply hold it against you. And the worst case scenario, they all, you know, I can get home within a day. The worst case scenario, we can drive home within a day, and if something terrible happens, it'll be all right. Having done the simple holiday, I then launched into a number of non-simple holidays. My first overseas trip on a plane was to Las Vegas, and I was cheap and I didn't get direct flights, so I had something like a 20-hour journey, which seemed like a good idea because it saved me about £100. I'd like to say I've learned from that, but I've not. Most of my journeys save £100 and end up being non-direct, but I've been lucky to travel all over the world, and that's been really instructive to me too, because it's taught me a lot. There are places that are more accessible than the UK. The US is a prime example. I've been whitewater rafting in the US. I've traveled to New York a few times. And it's really, really well set up. There are places where it's considerably less accessible than the UK, but they just don't care. They'll do whatever it needs to help you on your way. So we went on safari to Botswana, Namibia, and South Africa. I've been to Malaysia, went on my first relaxing holiday with my then girlfriend, oh no, actually then fiance, but first overseas holiday with my now wife, Laura, to India. And again, it reinforces to me how wonderful the world is, how much you can do if you're flexible, take some chances, and all the rest of it. But also, how lucky we are in the UK. I went to New York just before my accident, the summer before my accident, sort of July time. And the New York Yankees were out of town, the baseball team. So we went to watch the New York Mets, who are based in Queens. They're really rubbish, but we went to watch them anyway. And we got the 6 train out of Manhattan to Queens. And there's a guy who came shuffling through the carriage, double amputee, black guy, shaking a cup of pennies. And I didn't really think anything of it. I know about US, I know about their healthcare system, I know about, you know, relative wealth inequality and things like that, but it was kind of water off a duck's back. I didn't think it was particularly my problem, and I didn't really reflect on it at all. I'm trying to think how many years later. 3 years later, I went back to New York with some friends. And my life had obviously gone from up here to down here to actually, maybe not riding quite so high, but pretty good position. I was back at work. I had just moved into my new place. I was on holiday with my best friends going overseas to the US. The Yankees were playing out of town again. And so we went to watch the New York Mets. So we got the 6 train out of Queens, or 6 train out to Queens, their subway. And of all of the trains that could pass every hour, the same guy came through. And his life hadn't changed a jot. Now, it could be drugs. It could be booze. But in reality, it's an appalling healthcare system. It's huge wealth inequality. And the fact that he's from a poor black neighborhood and there was no one to help him out. And it's experiences like that and traveling around the world, doing fun things, but also, more poignant things. That's taught me how fortunate we are here in the UK. There is a lot that could be improved, depending on which way you swing politically. You may think big government, small government is a good idea, but the idea of universal healthcare is something that we should treasure and we should fight to keep. The idea that we've had a Disability Discrimination Act since the early 90s and that we have the earliest legislation in the UK in terms of disability discrimination came in the 1960s. And I previously thought all of this stuff was European, European initiatives. It's not. It's been domestic, UK domestic legislation that's been world leading for an incredible period of time. So travel and adventure have been wonderful fun, but they've also been huge learning experiences. I see, and I'm slightly envious of my friends who are working in Hong Kong or taking a year in Australia or Canada or whatever it may be. And I like the idea of doing that. And I know I could, but I know I wouldn't have as good a deal as I do being here. And there may be a few countries, Scandinavian countries or perhaps Germany and things like that, who have things better than we do, but we really are in the top half of the top division when it comes to our opportunities. But there was something missing in my life. I'd been back at work. I had been travelling around the world. I had a sporting life. And I was happy, genuinely happy. But of course, there was something missing. And I'd been trying along the way. But what really changed my life was meeting my match, who sadly isn't with us this evening, and she's probably quite glad because she'd be horribly embarrassed. But when I met Laura, we met at an ICAW conference, Institute of Chartered Accountants in England and Wales conference, a hotbed of matchmaking up in Liverpool. But it's been an absolutely mad 5 years, and I must admit, if you would have asked me 13 years ago, you can have this, and this, I'd have settled for half. Less than half, probably. And the notion that I've managed to marry someone who is my equal and better, who challenges me but supports me and is willing to put up with my weird baggage that comes with disability and deal with care assistance and all the rest of it is quite extraordinary. And it's only going to get slightly stranger too. As some of you will know, there is another baby car ride on the way. On the 16th of November, I'm assured that they come to time. On the 16th of November, plus or minus, life gets turned upside down and back to front, but in an incredibly positive way. And so, I mean, genuinely, I guess my conclusions and thoughts are that I'm an given that I was really stupid and also quite unlucky, I have been extraordinarily lucky to have a good family, to have good friends, to have communities who care, to have people who have believed in me, who are willing to give me a chance, and to have seen the power of volunteering and giving back in my transition out of hospital and through to the workplace has led me to do things and give back that has given me more than I think, given me more back than I think I've ever given in. I am truly, truly blessed and lucky, I think, to have had such an extraordinary journey over the last 13, well, coming up to 13 years. My challenge to myself early on after I was, you know, when I was in hospital, was to get to a position where if I could take a pill and be better tomorrow, that I would do it. And of course I would. You know, the idea of being able-bodied and not having to put up with all of the nonsense that I occasionally do with pressure sores and difficulties with personal care and whatever it may be. So that's one thing. But I wanted to reach a point where I would refuse the opportunity to go back and change it. And I'm very fortunate that I can say hand on heart that I wouldn't. If I could be better tomorrow, I would. But if I could go back and change it, I wouldn't, because the last 13 years have been a challenge, but have also been an absolute riot. And with that, I'm more than happy to take as many questions on as many different subjects as you might want. Come on, there's got to be something. Go for it.
What's sport next? So you've obviously done
wheelchair
rugby. Are there any other sports that you'd like to have a go at?
Functionally, there's not really that many others that I can do. But I do, I mean, I love sport. I watch a lot of it live. I mean, one of the small perks is that normally someone gets to come in with you to be your companion, which to begin with was my care assistant. And then I soon realised it was more fun going with family and mates, especially when they would buy the drinks and stuff like that. the really nice thing is my wife and I now go swimming, and it's one of the few times that I am not in a wheelchair next to her. So that's a really nice thing to do, and I hope it's, although I imagine the kid will drown me quite quickly. It will be something that we can do as a family, hopefully, quite nicely. Thank you. Who was next? Skip it.
So
you're
going to be daddy. 3 a.m. feed, yes or no?
On a joking note, I promised that I would do my best. On a serious note, I mean, this is something that we've had to think about, because I know that I am not going to be able to help out in the normal way. I don't have any dexterity in my hands and fingers. So my childhood growing up, my dad was a very practical father, fixing things, playing with toys and all the rest of it. And so that idea of fatherhood is something that I'm going to have to grow into. And it is something that makes me nervous, because I know Laura's going to have the real thick end of it for the first few years until they can do things by themselves and they respond. I mean, although most parents here would sort of say that kids never respond to what you tell them. But until that communication is there. So I will have to be a loving and supporting and present father, but someone who is not necessarily contributing in that way, which pains me, because I know she's going to suffer. You know, the 3 a.m. feeds were without too much of a break, but we may rope in the grandparents.
I'm useless at nappies.
Deliberately. Anyone else?
Go for it.
I just have to thank you for your positivity.
Yeah.
I was very lucky because I had quite a serious road accident and I came out of it quite unscathed, really, considering my considerable speed. And I was very blessed, I think, that I survived so well. And I just think your positivity and going on with your life, when you hear, no disrespect, Linda, and moment, I know when I went to Vietnam, our NHS here and our doctors are stretched, but golly, you come here, I think, and go abroad to some of these countries and what happens to them.
Yeah.
We have very little to complain about in this
country. I mean, that's something that I'm lucky to some extent, that, you know, and there were times that were dark in hospital and very difficult, especially when I had pressure sores. You know, I remember missing my dad's 50th birthday, you know, a big event that I desperately wanted to get up for, but my skin just wouldn't permit it. And that was really difficult. I'm lucky, I guess, that I had so many things going in my favour through stroke of luck. But what pains me, and it's something that I saw when I set up the wheelchair rugby club, I'd been injured for 6 years, and I was going to end up meeting people who'd been disabled from birth, who had, you know, had a lifetime's experience of disability. And I was expecting to be schooled by them and taught, you know, told, oh, you idiot, you're still doing it like that. What a rookie and, you know, what a schoolboy and all the rest of it. And what I found profoundly disconcerting was actually there were so many people who weren't like that. There were a few individuals who I met who were inspiring and positive, and the vast majority of them actually had done so little with what they have available to them. And my concern is, and I talked about the value and the importance of work, or at least contributing to society, or setting up that expectation that you do give something back, is that none of them have that instilled in them. Many of them have been to schools where, you know, they had no cognitive impairment at all, but they got a handful of GCSEs and they were, you know, roundly slapped on the back and told, you know, that's fantastic, that's great. Actually, these guys and ladies could have been scoring, you know, maybe not, you know, acing things, but scoring much more highly. The expectation that, you know, you're disabled and actually that you therefore don't need to work, or that it's inappropriate for you to work. Again, I have to be really careful when I talk about this, because I have a very unique experience and a very one-dimensional experience. It's me, but it's the value of those experiences being told, you know, knowing that you're only a small part of a machine, knowing that you can contribute, has been so important to my rehabilitation that if I had not had my job before having my accident, and I was having to apply for one afterwards, I'd be in a completely different circumstance. So we are really lucky, but I think we need to be really careful with the institutional support that we have to make sure that we give the right signals. Not that everyone can do what I've done or what other people might do, but in some way there is something that nearly everyone can contribute or give back. Any more?
No.
Cool. Thank you very much for having me. It's wonderful.
To say, follow that.
Thank you. Safe journey home, and thank you to everyone who've been, you know. What's been really nice is seeing so many familiar faces, because it was 13 years ago, and that was several years after I was probably more heavily engaged in the church, but I'm really lucky to catch up with them.